From NPR News in New York, this is the Bryant Park Project with Allison Stewart and Luke Burbank.
This is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News, your home on the
radio net pod MP3 thingy.
I'm Luke Burbank.
I'm Allison Stewart. It is September 11th, 2007.
Allison, you've been in New York for a number of 9/11s, I would say probably most of them, right?
I was there every night after the event.
This is my first one, and I have to say, not to get too navel-gazy, but it kind of feels different, 9/11, when you're in New York City than like L.A. where I was last year.
I can imagine, yeah. We're going to spend a good part of our show talking about the anniversary of 9/11.
The health effects of what happened at the World Trade Center, people are still trying to figure out exactly what happened there. And we're going to cut through some of that coming up later.
Also, we're going to talk a little bit about how difficult a day this can sometimes be to get across the facts of the day with the feelings and the emotions involved. We took to the streets of New York to talk to some people, and we'll give you some interesting statistics about how people think that 9/11 should be remembered.
And yesterday was a kind of a monumental day in the Bryant Park editorial meeting because Allison Stewart actually pitched a parrot. Wait, that was today.
It was this morning.
It all blurs together. Whatever meeting it was unique because you, I think, swore off Paris Hilton. But you pitched one, and it's in the Ramble because you're Allison Stewart.
And it's actually a news story, believe it or not. She actually made real news. Also, a really sad story about this football player who's likely to be paralyzed. We're going to talk to the team doctor with the Seattle Seahawks,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
About these sort of life-threatening injuries that happened on the field. We'll also get all the day's top headlines from Rachel Martin in just a minute. But first, here's today's BPP big story.
General David Petraeus, the top military commander in Iraq, and Ambassador Ryan Crocker testified before Congress yesterday. They gave their long-awaited reports on the status of the Iraq war. We're going to have a roundup of what some of the different editorial pages are making of that testimony. First, though, in case you missed it, a very quick recap of what these guys said.
They were basically two assertions that General Petraeus and Ambassador Crocker made. First, there have been problems in Iraq and things are still very difficult, but headway is being made. Here's Mr. Crocker.
While I would certainly share disappointment that progress has been slow on legislative benchmarks, that to my mind does not mean there has been no progress toward reconciliation. There has been.
The second point they made that was that withdrawing the troops now or in the near future would be a huge mistake that would make things worse, not better. Here's Ambassador Crocker describing that scenario.
An Iraq that falls into chaos or civil war will mean massive human suffering well beyond what has already occurred within Iraq's borders.
Well, today's editorial pages are chock full of responses. The Chicago Tribune writes, quote, "Nothing in Monday's statements by Petraeus and Crocker will bolster Democratic efforts in Congress to draw down U.S. forces any quicker than Petraeus recommends. But if some Americans don't like Monday's message, they needn't pillory the messengers. Neither Petraeus nor Crocker has been a White House toady."
The New York Times seems to disagree with the Trib pretty strongly. They write almost the opposite, quote, "For months, President Bush has been promising an honest accounting of the situation in Iraq, a fresh look at the war strategy, and a new plan for how to extricate the United States from the death spiral of the Iraqi civil war. The nation got none of that yesterday. It got more excuses, delaying serious decisions for many more months, keeping the war going into 2008 and probably well beyond," end quote.
One of the parts of Petraeus's testimony that received quite a bit of press focused on his hope that troop levels could be reduced to pre-surge levels next summer. The Des Moines Register focused on that aspect, writing, quote, "Monday's testimony could be regarded as a major turning point in debate on the war. The argument now isn't whether to stay or go. It's how quickly it can be done without triggering chaos."
USA Today also focused on the topic of withdrawal and took issue with Petraeus and Crocker's perceived unwillingness to state criteria for pulling out at least some troops next summer. They wrote, quote, "It's impossible to believe that Petraeus and Crocker don't have specific objectives they believe they can achieve over the next several months. If they don't, they're not suited to the job. They need to spell them out and recommit to benchmarks already in place.
All right, so that's a quick look and listen at some of the nation's editorial pages. Coming up, we'll talk about the health of people who were near ground zero in the weeks and months after 9/11. But first, we'll get to Rachel Martin with the news.
This is NPR.
Hi, everyone. Here's what's going on in your world. Relatives of those killed in the September 11th attacks gathered at a small park this morning in New York to mark the moment exactly 6 years ago when the first plane struck the towers. Against a backdrop of rain clouds and gray skies, Mayor Michael Bloomberg described September 11th as the day that tore across our history and our hearts. There was a moment of silence, then the family members and rescue workers began the annual recitation of the 2,750 names of the victims. The annual remembrance ceremony in New York was moved away from the World Trade Center site, which is now under active construction. Other memorials were held around the country today. President Bush observed a moment of silence at the White House, and there was a ceremony honoring the 40 passengers and crew who died when Flight 93 crashed in a Pennsylvania field. In New York, there were grumblings about today's involvement of GOP presidential candidate Rudy Giuliani in some of the events. Some have complained that Giuliani is using the 9/11 anniversary for political leverage, something the former New York mayor denies. And this year's anniversary is also shadowed by increasing concerns over the health of emergency responders, many of whom have become sick or died because of cancer or lung problems caused by the collapse of the Twin Towers. More on this story coming up later in the show. And on this day, 6 years after the attacks, there is a new message from the man who masterminded them. Osama bin Laden has released a new tape. In it, intelligence officials believe bin Laden's voice can be heard introducing the video testimony of one of the 9/11 hijackers, a Saudi man named Walid al-Shahari, who helped Mohammed Atta slam the first plane into the World Trade Center. Bin Laden describes al-Shahari as an exceptional man who defied danger. The tape was issued 4 days after bin Laden urged Americans to abandon capitalism and democracy in his first video appearance in 3 years. Senator Hillary Clinton has announced she will return $850,000 in campaign donations raised by Norman Hsu. He's the Democratic fundraiser jailed last week after trying to flee criminal charges in California. After spending 15 years dodging a warrant for corruption, Hsu eventually turned himself in last week, but then failed to appear at a hearing and was eventually arrested in Colorado. Clinton has already returned the $23,000 Hsu personally donated to her campaigns, and although Clinton is now returning the money raised by Hsu, a spokesman for Clinton says those individual contributors will be able to make new donations. And call it a publicity stunt or an honest-to-goodness musical showdown. Today, two titans in the world of rap release competing albums. 50 Cent and Kanye West have hyped the simultaneous release as an epic battle of rap giants. 50 Cent has gone so far as to say he'll retire from the business if West's album outsells his in their first week out. The two artists will perform tonight on the BET in a showdown that the network is treating like a top heavyweight fight, even borrowing an announcer from ESPN to deliver a statistical analysis of the two rap artists.
Kanye.
And the BET. We're just going to have to bust you there, Rachel Martin,
the
doing
BET.
The news. Did I just get busted?
Yeah. Can you say Kanye?
Kanye?
It's a simple name.
I'm Rachel Martin. The news is always online, which is maybe where you want to read it instead of listening to me. Allison and Luke, your turn. You try.
Thank you, Rachel. Appreciate it. There have been over 100 medical studies, 10,000 people signed up for class action lawsuits, 600-plus firefighters taking early retirement because of respiratory disease. Those are just some of the health-related consequences believed to be related to the events of September 11th, 2001. This year brought new medical evidence that some of those who lived and worked near the Twin Towers in New York City may be the victims of the air they breathed. Here to piece through the evidence with us is Beverly Weintraub, a member of the New York Daily News editorial board. The news won a Pulitzer Prize earlier this year for its series 9/11, The Forgotten Victims, which looked at the firefighters and others who say the air at Ground Zero made them sick. Hi, Beverly.
Hi.
So what are some of the most common symptoms and afflictions people claim that they have experienced as linked to the WTC attacks?
Well, there are a series of respiratory symptoms that showed up very early on, I think within the first day of the emergency workers coming down to the Trade Center site that have persisted to varying degrees up to this day. Shortness of breath, headaches, nosebleeds, chronic sinus infections, persistent asthma, what's been known as World Trade Center cough, which is a chronic cough combined with persistent acid reflux, and the two keep setting each other off. I think at this point, 6 years later, with all the medical studies and the treatment programs and all the people they've seen, there's really no doubt that those symptoms are absolutely linked to breathing in the toxins downtown.
Now, have these symptoms been limited to the workers and the first responders, or are we talking about people who actually live in the area as well?
Well, it's been most extensively documented among the workers who were there. Mm-hmm. The programs for the residents, the office workers, the students really got off to a late start. Some studies have documented asthma among people downtown.
Is it thought to be the immediate exposure to whatever was in the air, whether it's the asbestos or the pulverized concrete?
It's certainly a function of how soon after the towers collapsed, people came in, what respiratory protection they had, how long they were exposed over weeks and months.
It's interesting. One of the things that I read was that while they had this big Mount Sinai study, there have been many other smaller studies along the way. Can you tell us about some of the other studies, and of all the studies, which is considered to be really the definitive one?
Well, they all need to be taken together. Even now, there is no coherent picture of exactly how many people were down there, exactly what they did, exactly what they were exposed to, and exactly what their status is today. The Mount Sinai program, the fire department medical program, the City World Trade Center registry, the Bellevue program, which treats residents and office workers, all cater to different populations that were exposed to varying degrees. And all these medical studies are pretty much snapshots of these different populations at different times and what they were experiencing. None of them contradict each other. They are all consistent in the respiratory symptoms that they have found.
Let me ask you this, though. Yesterday, one of your competitors, the New York Post, had an op-ed calling some of these studies toxic pseudoscience. What's your response to that?
I think there's some disagreement within the medical community how much emphasis to give the projections as to what might be coming down the line. Some of the doctors are more emphatic than others. But like as I said, the studies do not contradict each other.
Hey, Beverly, is there in the reporting that your paper did, is there a particular person's story that kind of sticks in your mind when you're, you know, telling people about this series? Is there somebody that comes to mind?
Well, one of the people who contacted us, actually a friend of his contacted us, was a man named Vito Valenti, who was a part-time Board of Ed volunteer whose office just happened to be downtown. And when the towers collapsed, he and his boss looked at each other and said, "They need help. We need to go help." And he did, as a completely untrained rescue and recovery worker. He now has pulmonary fibrosis and walks around with an oxygen tank and needs a lung transplant.
Just from, do you know about how long he was in there?
For a couple months, I think.
Wow. One of the things that as we look forward to this, people have been talking about wanting more legislation and also wanting the government, local and federal, to take more responsibility. The one person who kind of took a lot of heat, obviously, was Christy Todd Whitman, the administrator of the EPA at the time. Let's replay this exchange. A lot of people remember this. Over the summer, this exchange she had with Congressman Keith Ellison at the beginning with her response to his question, did she believe the air at Ground Zero had made some people sick? Let's play that.
Congressman, I can't make that kind of a finding. That has to be based on the scientific data and the studies.
Okay, based on the scientific data and the studies, mm-hmm. Do you believe that people were made sick by toxins that were in the environment after 9/11?
If they come to those conclusions, I would have to agree, but I'd wait for those conclusions.
But Governor,
clearly we were concerned. Congressman, obviously we were concerned, or we wouldn't have recommended time and again that those working on the pile wear the appropriate safety protections.
It's interesting. Mayor Bloomberg just about a year ago said, quote, "I don't believe that you can say specifically a particular problem came from this particular event." Yet the city has announced a new website as a clearinghouse for information about 9/11 health related issues. What has changed in the past year, Beverly?
Well, there is a conflict between wanting to prove to a medical certainty a cause and effect and being able to say in the particular specific case of a particular person, yes, I am sickened because of this, and having sick people who are clearly sick with symptoms no one would expect, given the job they normally do, who need help and wanting to help them. The problem is that if you wait for medical certainty to be reached, that can take decades, and the people need help now. So in terms of public policy, there needs to be a line drawn that, well, you can't be 100% sure, but something needs to be done anyway.
Beverly Weintraub, member of the Daily News, the New York Daily News editorial board, thanks for sharing a lot of your reporting with us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Coming up on the Bryant Park Project, we're going to talk about this really horrendous football injury that happened over the weekend. Doctors now saying this fellow from the Buffalo Bills is paralyzed. We're going to talk to a team doctor with an NFL team about that.
All right. All that's coming up on the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. Welcome back to the Bryant Park Project. I'm Allison Stewart, and yes, the microphone light is on.
That's right. When that light comes on, that's when we talk.
And we're from NPR News.
That's right.
All right, now I've done everything I'm supposed to do.
I'm Luke Burbank. Coming up, you're going to want to get out your protractor. We're going to talk Tesseracts when we have an incredibly highbrow memorial for Madeleine Langell, author of A Wrinkle in Time, a great video that our video producer Wynn Rosenfeld put up that will probably make your head explode if you watch it. But I still recommend it.
I do as well.
All right. It's time, though, for that time in the show when we do something we like to call the ramble. Allie, what do you call this? News?
News you're not sure you can use, but we bet you'll like it.
All right. Well, here comes some. San Francisco Mayor Gavin Newsom has asked hundreds of top city officials to voluntarily resign, but most of the resignations are not going to be accepted. He says,
please quit.
It's like that scene in Austin Powers when Dr. Evil kicks everyone out of the room, yeah, and then invites them all back in except Mini-Me. Okay, I was the only person who saw Austin Powers 3. The point is, he says he wants to make bold change in the coming term. He's up for re-election. Some people, though, think that his motivation is that he wants to fire a few certain people, but he doesn't want to have to actually specifically fire them, so he's going to fire everybody and then just not rehire those people.
Oh, so he's both lame and mean for doing
this?
Yeah,
and passive-aggressive, so two for two.
Body Shop founder and activist Anita Roddick died. She was only 64 years old. It was of a brain hemorrhage. A lot of people know the Body Shop. It's these nature-based cosmetics companies. They launched it in 1976. A lot of her stores that are in communities give money back to the community. She gave about $1.8 million to Amnesty International. She once said, though, of beauty products, I hate the beauty industry. It's a monster selling unattainable dreams. It lies. It cheats. It exploits women. Yet she sold her company to L'Oreal.
There are two distinct smells when you walk through the Northgate Mall in Seattle, Cinnabon and the Body Shop.
Oh.
You could always kind of locate yourself from an olfactory standpoint. In a story that Allison pitched, yes, she did, Paris Hilton is suing Hallmark Cards for unauthorized use of her face and trademark catchphrase on a greeting card. The card features Hilton's face on a cartoon body and says, first day as a waitress. The joke is on Hilton, or rather the joke is Hilton is warning a soup-eating customer, that's not hot. Okay, I see. So it's Paris Hilton's first day as a waitress, and she's telling someone who's eating soup, that's not hot.
as if she needs the damages.
Yeah.
How much is she suing for?
$100,000 at least.
Ridiculous. Janet Jackson's wardrobe malfunction has once again entered the legal realm. The third U.S. Circuit Court. The third U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in Philadelphia. They're going to hear arguments about this. This thing happened in 2004 at the Super Bowl. It is 2007. Fortunately, there'll be no cameras in the courtroom. The FCC fines CBS $550,000 for airing that incident. No FCC indecency fines have been levied since March of 2006. This story needs to go away. That was editorializing by me, by the way.
Yeah, that's okay. I support you in that, Allie. Seriously, like, aren't the courts backed up? I mean, this is really the most pressing issue?
Maybe so. Hey, that does it for The Ramble.
It wasn't a particularly interesting play or a particularly vicious-looking tackle, but a guy named Kevin Everett's life will never be the same after last Sunday's game between the Denver Broncos and the Buffalo Bills. During a kickoff, Everett crashed into another player's shoulder pad and immediately fell to the turf, motionless. Doctors now say that Everett is paralyzed from the shoulders down and that his chances of recovery, physically anyway, are, quote, dismal. Now, believe it or not, this is actually a pretty rare occurrence in pro football. I think the last player paralyzed in an on-the-field play was a guy named Mike Utley. I think that was back in 1991. We've got Stan Herring here to talk to us about
it. But you know what? I think our guest is they're having a moment. They're trying to get the guest on the line.
Oh, Stan Herring?
Yeah. So well, this way the story actually came about, we talked about a little bit in our meeting, that MJ, one of our producers, discussed that she had read somewhere about injecting steroids immediately into someone who's hurt.
Yeah, because
it makes such a huge difference.
Well, because the thing, I've actually been on the sidelines of some of these pro football games covering them, and it is like a 20-car crash every play. These people are enormous.
It's amazing you said that. Last night, I was watching football with somebody, and he said, watch this play. It's amazing that these guys can get up. And it was these two, I think they were college players, and their helmets just crashed. And you would think they would never be able to stand up again, but...
And TV does not even do it justice.
Yeah, that's you're on the sidelines.
Most insane part. No, but I mean, like, it's like a thundering herd of guys. So they do this all the time, and yet you'd think guys are getting paralyzed every play, and yet it doesn't seem to happen. And what MJ had read was because they had a procedure for injecting players with steroids, a whole bunch of steroids on the field. So we wanted to find out about that. Do we have our guy?
We're still working on it. We're still working
If you want to talk to me, Dan, you should probably press the button that goes into my headphone.
Can you guys hear me all right?
No. Still not working. Why don't you... One finger means we have the guest. Two fingers means we don't. Okay. Well, anyway, it just was amazing, I think, as a football fan, to think that this isn't something that happens
more often. You know, actually, I'm going to dive in here to some of the notes that the doctor sent us about this. Apparently, this steroid injection is not new science, which we also found interesting. We were talking about this a little bit, that they've been doing this since the early 1990s. But my question, if we get the doctor on the phone ever, is did we just take 5 years off of some guy's life by choosing to do this? Is this a short-term fix? What are the results of suddenly injecting a healthy man?
Yeah. I think probably most of them would take that deal,
yeah,
you know, on balance in terms of recovering physically. But I also kind of was wondering if, you know, you see a guy, it's not often someone's actually paralyzed, but it's fairly often someone goes down with a neck injury.
Yeah.
And they cart them off the field and they almost always recover. It seems like they have a higher rate of kind of reviving these guys in the NFL than just in the population at large. I was wondering, and maybe the doctor, if we ever get him, can tell us about this.
Hey, guys, can you hear me now?
Yeah, we can hear you, Dan.
Yeah, it looks like we're not going to have the doctor, but it is an interesting story. You're absolutely right.
Are you on the radio right now?
Yes, I am.
Oh, this is sweet. Is this our new device?
Yes, can you believe it?
This is our new fancy microphone that allows Dan in the studio to talk to us so that the listeners don't think that we're just insane people.
Making it up along the way.
Yeah, like he's our imaginary friend. Dan Pashman, welcome to the show. Yes, it is.
So what's the deal, Dan?
Yeah, what's going on exactly?
Well, you're right, Allison, that it's not necessarily new science, these steroid injections. It was actually medical science came up with this stuff back in the mid to late 1990s, and it actually took a while for it to get to football. But it's done some tremendous work. There's a guy named Tommy Maddox from the Pittsburgh Steelers who had a very horrific on-field injury a couple years ago. Looked a lot like the one from this past weekend. This guy had a head-first collision, basically dropped to the field motionless, and was ready to play the next week had it not been for the high quantity of steroids that had been injected into his body, which, for another medical reason, made it dangerous for him to be on the field.
Well, we should try to get this doctor guy on at some point because I want to find out if that's something that they should do. They have actual...
Is this a scheduling snafu or is this just a he's gone MIA?
He's gone MIA. We couldn't get in touch with his cell phone. But I think that we can wrap up this topic and go ahead and move on to music because our lovely music correspondent is ready to rock.
All right. But we're going to talk about this football thing tomorrow because I'm actually super interested in it.
All right.
Unlike most of the topics, which that would imply I'm not interested in.
Get ready to turn it up to 11. We all heard about the Kanye West and 50 Cent and these new releases and this beef and all that. So on this New Music Tuesday, we want to check out some of the less hyped new music, including a follow-up record for some UK Groovsters, some bratty Atlanta rockers, and a time-worn singer-songwriter. Helping us out today is Melissa Maritz, senior editor from Rolling Stone magazine. Hey, Melissa.
Hey, how's it going?
Going forward.
What do you know about paralysis in football? Football players, Melissa.
I am the expert on
such
things.
Oh, perfect.
She's an editor. She's an MD.
We actually only write about musicians who have been paralyzed in accidents like that.
Wow, so. That's perfect. Perfect.
I want to talk about the Go Team, the six-piece from Brighton, England. Not a lot going on in Brighton. It's a pretty little beach town, but not a whole heck of a lot going on there. Second release called Proof of Youth. Let's listen to a track called Grip Like a Vice. All right, so is there sophomore slump here? I like what I hear there, or have they evolved?
Well, I think that this is going to be a big record for them. This is a rare combination of a guy who's kind of an indie rocker who does sample-based music that's based on B-movies and a lot of kind of obscure background things, and then a rapper who brings in a lot of good hip-hop. So Chuck D from Public Enemy guests on this record. There's a group called the Double Dutch Divas from the 80s who are rapping, and a group called the Rapper's Delight Club, which is a group of grade school students who are rapping in the background. So it's a pretty eclectic record, and it's pretty great.
I got to tell you, if you need something to put on your jogging mix for your iPod, the Go Team's first record, and probably this one too, it got me up Massachusetts Avenue in D.C. so many times when I thought I was out of gas. It's good stuff.
They actually have a group of cheerleaders on this record, so maybe that'll help you while you're jogging.
Go Team. Yeah. Hey, if you like loud, raw, punkish music, the Black Lips could be for you. Their new release is called Good, Bad, Not Evil. So which is it, good, bad, or not evil?
It's all of the above. These guys are from Georgia, and they've been around for a while, but their profile got bigger this past year. They played at the music festival South by Southwest in Austin, Texas, and they played dozens and dozens of shows just over a couple of days, and a lot of people took notice, and they're kind of known for their crazy live shows. They've had fireworks on stage, they've had fighting on stage, they've had nudity on stage. It's just been kind of a wild group, and this record is every bit as dirty and great and, you know, lively as that sounds.
All right. Let's take a listen to this track from the Black Lips. It's called Cold Hands. So my question is, you describe their stage antics. Is that integral to their music? Is it their shtick? Or are they genuinely brawlers and short-tempered brat punks?
Well, it depends on who you ask. I think they're definitely a love-it-or-hate-it kind of band. You know, some people think it's all just shtick and a gimmick, and other people are really into it. I think it just matters on how much you're willing to put up with if you're in the front row.
So Athens, Georgia, they're coming your way on the 12th of September. They're going to be in Detroit on the 25th. Worcester, Mass. as well. They're on a big fat tour, so you can go see for yourself if you want. Joe Henry has this new album out. He recorded in just 3 days. It's called Civilians. I'm a big Joe Henry fan. I know you're indulging me here. Give us a little background on Joe Henry.
Well, I mean, he's probably most famous for being married to Madonna's sister.
Oh, that hurts me.
No.
But like in the beginning, but also, you know, has worked with he's been a great producer as well as a great musician. I think he's worked with a lot of R&B artists in the past, like Solomon Burke and Betty LaVette, and you can kind of hear a little bit of that on this record. It sounds a lot like Tom Waits to me, but it just seems like it's a really good, kind of gritty record.
And let's take a little listen to this song. It's called Our Song from Joe Henry.
This was our country. This was our song. Somewhere in the middle there, oh, it started bad and it's ending wrong. This was our country. This frightful land, this angry land. But it's my right if the worst.
It's interesting. He was, because of that song and the title of the record, Civilians, and it being released on 9/11, he was asked about whether this was a political record or not. And he said he didn't really decide to write anything political, but he let it happen if he saw that element surfacing in his writing. And Melissa, I just kind of wanted to get your take on the release of records on September 11th. This is the first Tuesday since 2001, when September 11th fell on a Tuesday. Was there been much discussion around your office or within the record companies about whether or not to go ahead and release something on this day?
Well, you know, it's tough. I remember the day that, you know, the original September 11th, when records came out, a lot of records got taken into a context they weren't necessarily intended for originally, but it really became important to people. I think Ryan Adams' record was released around that time. It wasn't the same exact date, but
had that song, New York.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it became really important to people in a way that I don't think Ryan Adams originally intended, but it was kind of great. So it's kind of tough, I think, to take any album that mentions anything patriotic or, you know, having to do with, you know, national identity in a way that isn't connected with the date.
All right. Can I go from the serious to the seriously ridiculous?
Please do.
Did you watch the Video Music Awards?
Who didn't?
All right. I've got two questions.
Okay.
Is Britney Spears' career over after that performance? And what did you think of the song?
Well, you know, the song is great. You know, it's
the
like,
song
not...
is good.
The song
yes!
is great.
I'm with you, Melissa. It's a good song.
Good. I'm so glad you feel the same way. Yeah. I mean, it's not, you know, it's a great song. The performance was really sad.
She looked, I felt it looked like, and by the way, if you have not seen it, you need to get on YouTube and watch this thing. It looked like a sorority hazing where they got someone super drunk and made them lip sync to a
Britney
Spears
song. Oh, see,
I thought
she looked Spears like the drunk girl from Saturday Night Live. Like, I love it. You're my best friend. Let's dance.
Some combo of the two.
She looked like she was trying not to fall over most of the time.
Yeah. What shoes did they have her in? They were bad.
Who knows? And, you know, it's just sad to see that happen. She was just so dazed. And then right afterward, having Sarah Silverman kind of lay into her, it just kind of felt sad, like this slow train wreck that everybody was watching.
But the song's good, so say Allison and
great.
Melissa.
I'm sure the record's going to be great, too.
It's a testament to production, let's just say that.
Yes.
And it'll be interesting to see if this thing sells, if it sells records, because she is such a sort of, she's such a traffic accident in her personal life and with the head shaving. But maybe the record's good enough that people will listen to it, it'll get play.
I think regardless, she's still going to be in the tabloids.
That's a good call. Melissa Maritz is senior editor for Rolling Stone magazine. As always, thanks a bunch, Melissa.
Thanks, guys.
All right, now we have managed to track down Dr. Stan Herring. Just before we talked to Melissa, we were talking about this injury over the weekend to a guy named Kevin Everett, Buffalo Bills player, who hurt himself, and it looks like he's now paralyzed. We wanted to find out a little bit more about sort of what happens on the field when this kind of injury is sustained. Are you there, Dr. Herring?
I am here.
You're the team doctor for the Seattle Seahawks. You specialize in rehabilitation and spinal disorders. These guys, as we were saying a minute ago, are gigantic, and they are running really fast and crashing into each other head first. How is it that more people don't get paralyzed, frankly?
Well, it's rare, but can be devastating, and there's a lot of reasons, including coaching. See what you hit is an NFL rule and a rule in college and high school, so you don't tackle with your head down.
See what you hit means basically have your head up when you run into a guy. Don't stick your head down.
Tackle his numbers. Don't put your head down.
I mean, is there something with has the equipment, you know, sort of advanced to the point where it's a little more protective?
In some ways. I mean, the rigid helmet, the plastic helmet, makes it less likely to have a skull fracture, but unfortunately sometimes allows the players to use the helmet as a weapon. So sometimes equipment can be helpful for certain injuries, but actually promote others.
Have you actually attended to a spinal injury on the field?
Yes.
What's that like? What's the first thing you do when you get out there?
First thing you do is you depend upon your training. I cannot overemphasize that. You should not be thinking this through as a first-time event when it happens. So we rehearse and rehearse and rehearse, hopeful you'll never have to use it. But it's a well-orchestrated recovery response. Initially, the certified athletic trainer, in our case, is on the field and signals us if there's concern, and then we have a protocol where we go out, someone controls a player's head, we do a quick assessment, we have Medic One or our paramedic facility available, and then we have a process of assessment, stabilization, and transfer.
Dr. Herring, what's the most challenging part of dealing with a spinal injury on the field?
It is a live situation in an unfamiliar environment. Doctors aren't used to practicing medicine on the 50-yard line. And so you have a player down, other players around. It's loud. You don't have your usual stuff. And you have to make important and at times life-determining conditions in a short period of time.
You've looked down into a player's eyes when they have this kind of spinal injury. Are they just terrified?
It depends. These are tough guys at all levels. Sometimes the player is confused because they've had a concussion along with a spinal injury. Other times, as you might imagine, this is chaos. And I think it is every man responds differently. But certainly, as you can imagine, the capacity going from being an athlete to not being able to move or being only able to move partially or being confused or having significant pain is very concerning. Certainly part of the job of the medical team is to make that environment as safe and as oriented as possible for the player.
One of the things we heard about in our meeting yesterday, which we were trying to get to the bottom of, was this question of is it sometimes a remedy to inject a player with a bunch of steroids?
Not the steroids that you're worried about.
No. Oh, well, I mean, we didn't mean it that way, but what are you injecting them with, and how does that help?
Right. There is some evidence, and actually a significant amount of that work was done at my hospital here at Harborview in Seattle, that if a patient has a spinal cord injury, that giving them a large dose of corticosteroids, certainly within the first 8 hours of the injury, does help to moderate the damage. It's not a magic cure, but for the last certainly 10 years or so, in the situation, as you've described, at the right time, within certainly the first 8 hours, a large dose of steroids would be given initially and then followed for 1 to 2 days. It helps with recovery.
Dr. Herring, do you have kids?
Yes, I do.
Would you let them play football?
Yes, I would let them play football for two reasons. One, every decision involves risk. And secondly, organized activity after school, no matter what it is a lot safer than unorganized activity.
Hmm. Dr. Stan Herring, the team doctor for the best team in the NFL, the Seattle Seahawks.
we are undefeated.
That's right, 1-0, and looked good in the second half. All right, I'm from Seattle, I'm sorry. Dr. Herring, thanks very much for coming on and talking to us about this.
Thank you.
What do we got coming up next, Allison?
Coming up on the Bryant Park Project, we're going to talk about The Wrinkle in Time. It's called a tesseract for anybody who has read the book. Our video producer, Wynn Rosenfeld, found a professor who figured out how to draw and explain that fourth dimension in time.
And as somebody already commented on the Bryant Park blog, this is one of those examples where the video aspect of this show is totally helpful. It's impossible to explain it verbally, but if you look at the illustration, maybe you can kind of get it. I still can't get it, but maybe a reasonably intelligent person
can. Well, if you go to npr.org/Bryant Park, you can read it, see it, watch it. You can also listen to The Bryant Park Project from NPR News. Thank you.
Welcome back to the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. We're blogging at npr.org/Bryant Park. I'm Luke Burbank.
And I'm Allison Stewart. Coming up, hold on to your brains because we're going to blow them with a combination of physics and children's literature. In fact, there is a prop on my desk. If someone would grab that and bring it in, it would be awesome.
Mind explosion. Also, we're going to take a look at the facts and the feelings surrounding the 6th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. First, though, let's get an update on today's news with Rachel Martin.
This is NPR.
Hi, everyone. Here's what's going on in your world. General David Petraeus and Ambassador Ryan Crocker returned to Capitol Hill today for a second round of testimony about the war in Iraq. In his opening statement yesterday, Petraeus told a congressional committee that the additional 30,000 U.S. troops deployed this year have improved security in Iraq to the point where some troops can begin coming home in the next couple months. But Petraeus insists that success in Iraq will take time.
While noting that the situation in Iraq remains complex, difficult, and sometimes downright frustrating, I also believe that it is possible to achieve our objectives in Iraq over time, although doing so will be neither quick nor easy.
The general has proposed a gradual drawdown that would bring troop numbers back to pre-surge levels by next summer. Some Democratic leaders called the proposal positive, but they're still pushing bills that would mandate a timetable for withdrawal. Memorial ceremonies marking the 6th anniversary of the September 11th attacks are taking place around the country today. This morning, in a gray and rainy New York City, families of victims of the attacks gathered at a small park close to the World Trade Center site. There was a moment of silence and the annual recitation of the names of the 2,750 victims of the World Trade Center attacks. In Washington, D.C., President Bush also honored a moment of silence, and in Pennsylvania, a ceremony was planned to honor the 40 passengers and crew who died in United Airlines Flight 93. A California man has been sentenced to 24 years in federal prison for attending a terrorist training camp in Pakistan, then returning to the U.S. willing to wage violent jihad. Hamid Hayat, a U.S. citizen, was convicted in April 2006 of providing material support to terrorists and lying about it to FBI agents. Prosecutors said Hayat intended to attack hospitals, banks, and government buildings in California. The 25-year-old could have received almost 40 years in prison, but yesterday a federal judge imposed a lesser sentence, citing Hayat's lack of a previous criminal record. And it's Tuesday. That means last night was Monday Night Football. And here's a recap. The Cincinnati Bengals took advantage of 6 turnovers, beating the Baltimore Ravens 27-20. And in the West, the San Francisco 49ers found the end zone in the final seconds of the game against the Arizona Cardinals, taking home a 2017 win. Go Niners. I'm Rachel Martin. The news is always online at npr.org. Luke and Allison, back to you.
Thank you, Rachel. Well, yesterday we had what felt like about a two-hour discussion.
Because it was a two-hour discussion. That's why.
Very un-air-conditioned conference room in our very un-air-conditioned, beautiful studios about one specific topic, and that was 9/11 and the 6th anniversary and how exactly we should talk about it as a show. And at the end of this very long conversation, we seemed to sort of get down to two themes, which are the facts and the feelings.
And the emotions about it. Mm-hmm. So we wanted to try to cover both, get you a few facts. People were asking questions in our meeting about what's happening at the various sites. Well, after a couple years of political wrangling and a whole bunch of disagreement, this week Larry Silverstein, the developer in charge of rebuilding the World Trade Center site, announced construction would begin on January 08, and the three towers, including a memorial, a pedestrian mall, and office space, he says will be open for business by 2012, the total price tag $7 billion.
The Pentagon has been repaired since American Airlines Flight 77 slammed into it. It killed 184 people. One of those people was Barbara Olson. She is the late wife of Ted Olson. Ted Olson is expected to be nominated as the new U.S. Attorney General next week.
Now, the memorial in Pennsylvania for those aboard Flight 93, that's been held up and is expected to be at least 4 years away. It's been delayed due to a high level of the element manganese, and it's appeared at the crash site 3 to 4 times the acceptable amount to the EPA. Now, the land, which is privately owned, must be transferred to the Park Service before construction to begin on the memorial for the 40 victims.
Now, in terms of some of the conspirators on September 11th, suspected mastermind Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, he's in U.S. custody, as are some others. Of course, Osama bin Laden remains at large and released a video today.
So those are some of the facts that we dug up. But we want to talk about the emotions around the day and how people are integrating the anniversary into their lives, if they are. There was a USA Today article titled, "Is 9/11 Just Becoming Another Calendar Date?" The paper cites its own poll with its Gallup poll, and it said 6% of people would observe the anniversary in some sort of formal way, attending a memorial event, taking the day off.
71% said they would mark it informally, perhaps by praying or maybe taking a moment of silence, certainly watching news coverage. A lot of people will be doing that. Almost one quarter of people surveyed said they didn't plan to observe it at all.
This got us thinking a little bit about, we all knew what we felt and what we were going to do. So we sent the Bryant Park Project's producer, Wynn Rosenfeld, out to Times Square. It's the crossroads of the world. You talk to people from Brazil, people from New York, people from London, all over the world, because we have to remember there weren't just Americans who died that day, to get a sampling of opinions about remembering September 11th, 2001.
I think that you can't be human and living in this country without having some sense of remembrance and reverence for what has happened, and just remembering the people who've lost loved ones, and as well those who themselves were lost, and just giving respect.
There is going to be people that they don't want to, no longer want to discuss it. You know, it's like, well, it's happened. But I think that's sad, really, because I think, you know, you need to, especially for my children growing up, you know, they need to know that certain things can happen.
Is there any sort of commemoration that you would personally do?
Well, I know I'm going to watch my ass. I work here at Times Square every day around a lot of people. And, you know, you never know. People do celebrate anniversaries like that in all kinds of negative ways. I mean, I'm going to give it some thought in the morning. A lot of people lost their lives, a lot of innocent people, you know, and for no good reason. So I guess in that way, yeah, I will.
I'm a foreigner. It's like it's 5 years down the line. There's a whole lot of people around here, and this is like a perfect kind of spot where something bad would happen here. You kind of get like, it's not like you really worry about it, but you think, you know, there's a possibility. Am I safe?
I learned to appreciate things more. It's different whenever I'm on the Riverside Drive, yeah, and I'm driving. That was a sight to see, you know? Yeah. People come from all over the world just to see stuff like that.
I guess it's really having an appreciation for the fact that life is short and that our loved ones at any time, including ourselves, could be impacted by just terrible acts from around the world.
All right, Allison, let's just kind of go back to that USA Today headline that asked, is 9/11 just becoming another calendar date? I mean, I think this is a real thing that we in the media struggle with. You know, should 9/11 every year be the top story of the show? I mean, we went around and around.
Yeah.
Even this morning, it was like the show didn't get on the air almost because we were still debating it, you know, an hour before air. And for people too, I think it's a real fair question. If you're somebody who lost somebody in that day, of course, this is something that will never go away. But if you're just a person that lives in Iowa, you know, what's a sort of appropriate way to commemorate this? Is it just taking a moment to think about it? Is it okay to not think about it?
And we were also talking about the sort of, as somebody pointed out in the meeting, the artificial numbers that 1 and 5 seem to be important, and then ten be the next big anniversary? And the question was, are those artificial? But we live in the world where those are the markers, so it's understandable why people might have a change of feeling in between, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9. What do you do during those anniversaries personally? What do you do them professionally? Well, it's something we'll have to deal with doing this show.
I will say that, you know, yesterday in the meeting, I was kind of putting forth this argument that for a lot of people who didn't have personal involvement, and I say this because I come from the West Coast most recently, saying maybe it's not a big deal to people out there, or at least, you know, it's just not something that's quite as top of mind. Having said that, I was sort of making the argument for the fact that this is receding into people's minds. And this morning, MSNBC was showing the kind of real-time footage of what happened, and it was so affecting.
Yeah.
I was looking at it like, I was like, wanted to retract everything I had said in the meeting yesterday. Because, I mean, you see those things on fire. You see little loose pieces of paper coming out of the building. And maybe it could be 50 years, and it still, I think, is going to blow your mind.
And the point someone else made was, that's one of those places everybody can tell you exactly what they were doing that day, exactly where they were, and exactly what they spent their time and what was important to them to do. Was it important to call a family member? Was it important to volunteer? Was it important to turn off the TV? Was it important to get another TV and a radio and listen to more of it? It was just really interesting the way different people reacted. And one of the things that we wanted to do was on our blog, everybody in our staff has very diverse experiences and experienced that day in a very different way. We didn't want to put it on the radio show because it's not about us. Yeah. But as for our folks,
plus,
who
have you heard some of these people's speaking voices?
But if you've been to the blog, you know that we often share personal stories, and you've gotten to know us through the blog and through the comments section. So a little bit later on, we're going to all post our different experiences from that day.
Yeah, because it is one of those things that even if you are geographically very far from New York, you remember and you feel like that's part of – you're part of the 9/11 story even mm-hmm. if you weren't in New York.
Yep.
So, yeah. So
website?
Definitely go to the blog. And also, it's going to be in the comment section. So comment away, little listeners.
NPR.org/Bryant Park. Welcome back to the Bryant Park Project from NPR News.
We've got Wynn here to talk about his wrinkle in time.
Oh, okay. We're going there.
That's what your prop is all about.
That's right. I'm sorry.
You called for a prop.
Well, we'll talk about this later. You know what? There's a weird coincidence going on. Over the weekend, I stumbled on my original copy of Wrinkle in Time. I have it right here. What does it say on the spine there?
Allison Stewart. Homeroom. What is that?
213.
213. You wrote on the... Oh, my God. That is...
Yes. Dog-eared, battered, blue. I spilled some sort of Elmer's glue on the front of it at some point. But I loved this book, and I actually found it this weekend, which is so weird and strange considering that the author of it died this weekend, Madeline L'Engle. And her passing, for anybody who read this book, it reminded you of this mysterious story of three kids who travel through time. They find that wrinkle in time to save their father. Now, that wrinkle in the book is called a tesseract. This is a very pre-Potter, in my opinion. So do you know what a tesseract is, the way they tried to describe it to us? Well, apparently one professor does, and our video producer, Wynn Rosenfeld, met him. His name is David Morgan at the New School. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
All right, Wynn, tell us a little bit more. First of all, why is this guy studying tesseracts?
Well, tesseracts are apparently very, very important for anybody who wants to talk about theoretical physics at all, because in order to sort of understand general relativity or anything that has to do with multi-dimensions, tesseract is basically the sort of the most basic form of talking about things beyond what we can see in three-dimensional world.
And he was able to illustrate it in
sort of
a way.
Yeah.
Sort of.
Yeah, he can illustrate the what he calls something that looks like the shadow of what a tesseract would look like. But you can't actually draw a tesseract because that would require you being able to see things that aren't visible in the space that we live in.
But you can understand it in the abstract. This next clip sort of helps you go there. Can you set it up?
Right, yeah. Well, it's one of these things that's very hard to understand intuitively, but for mathematics, it's really quite easy. And here's him talking about that.
You really can't think in four dimensions, but it's really easy to do math in four dimensions. For example, if I ask, what's the size of this line in one dimension, you say, well, it's L. It has a length. Say, what's the size of the square in two dimensions? Well, size in two dimensions is something we call area. The size of a square is L squared. We say, what's the size of this cube in three dimensions? Three-dimensional size is something we call volume, and the volume of a cube is L cubed. And I've never had a student not know the answer to the next question, which is, what is the four-dimensional size of a hypercube or a tesseract? And the answer is, it's L to the fourth.
I just realized when I watched that clip how much I'm not meant to study whatever it is this guy teaches, because he goes, I've never had a student not know the answer to that. And I thought to myself, I would never know the answer to that.
See, I must have been nerd patrol. I was like yelling, L4 at your video on the blog. So out of all of this, did you get anything that practically you can employ in your life?
No, not really. I mean, it's not stuff that, unless you are a theoretical physicist, you know, those aren't things that are going to become important to you dealing with, you know, the world and your studies. But that being said, a lot of, you know, practical things we do today are based on, you know, Einstein's theories of relativity. And for the people who really understand that on a deep level, this stuff is very important.
All right. You should watch the video at our site, npr.org/Bryant Park. It will blow your mind.
That's the sound. That's the sound of minds blowing all over the internet.
Hey, Wynn, thanks a lot.
Thanks, guys.
All right. Well, keeping it very scientific and highbrow on this show, you know, the differences between humans and apes, fairly apparent. We live in houses. We watch Grey's Anatomy. They don't. But the thing that's always kind of perplexed people who study evolution is, at what point did humans suddenly develop this growing a lot bigger physically and getting their brains much larger, much more so than apes did, which allowed us to kind of make this big leap? A paper published online recently in Nature Genetics says the big difference might actually be spit. Apparently, human spit allows for digesting more starch, which could be a huge deal. We've got Nate Dominey here. He's a professor of anthropology at the University of California at Santa Cruz, one of the lead authors of the study. Hi, Nate.
Hi. How's it going?
Good, good. So the study found that humans have more of something called salivary amylase gene. What does that mean?
Well, the salivary amylase gene codes for an enzyme called salivary amylase, and this enzyme is critically important for digestion because it hydrolyzes starch. That is to say, it converts starch into glucose, which our cells need for everyday purposes.
And this study comes at the same time that another study came out that found that starch may have been a huge part of human development.
Yes. There's this hypothesis in anthropology that the shift from a ape-like diet, which is to say apes today tend to rely principally on ripe fruits, and that something changed in the human lineage, that they shifted away from this ape-like diet to something that was really quite hard. And there's been a lot of speculation about what those hard objects might have been. And one suggestion is that they started to dig up roots and tubers and corms and bulbs. These are the underground storage organs of plants in arid environments. And these are food items that are really quite starchy.
Aren't apes evolving too still, though? I mean, are they just a couple hundred million years behind us? Are they going to get their hands on some of these enzymes or these genes and then start eating starches and then immediately enslave the world?
No, I don't think that's likely. They do have the gene, and they do produce some salivary amylase, just nothing near to the extent that we humans produce it. And that was the aim of our study, was to see why is our mouth just full of this salivary amylase?
That was my question. Why did you suddenly go, spit, apes, evolution, it makes sense to us, let's study it. How do you get there?
Well, we were at the perfect environment, actually. We were at the Institute of Human Origins at Arizona State University, and we were just sitting around one day eating pizza, which is very doughy and full of starch, and we were just asking ourselves, how could we test this hypothesis that starch was so important? I mean, after all, these are plant tissues. They're not going to preserve in the fossil record. And moreover, the tools that early hominins might have been using to dig them up are such as wooden sticks. They wouldn't preserve either. So we thought maybe there might be molecular clues in our genomes. And we thought that amylase, because it hydrolyzes starch, because it digests starch, could be the smoking gun for testing this hypothesis.
It's good to hear that so much evolutionary theory comes from college grad students eating pizza, yes, sitting around and doing whatever else you guys do. Nate Dominey, professor of anthropology at the University of California, Santa Cruz, thanks for telling us about this.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And thanks for listening to another hour of the Bryant Park Project. Our big old staff is growing and growing. It includes Ilya Maritz, MJ Davis, Dan Pashman, Wynn Rosenfeld, Rachel Martin, and our intern Karen Toby, as well as Manoli Weatherall.
Manoli looks like she's at a Quiet Riot concert in there, or having a spasm of some kind.
Senior producer is Matt Martinez. Our editor is Tricia McKinney.
I'm Luke Burbank.
I'm Allison Stewart. Sharon Hoffman is our executive producer. This is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News.